This is a Pinball News production.
Well, whenever I see a group like here, I'd like to ask you, first of all, how many of you are here for the first time?
My name is...
Holy mackerel. I'm Steve Corley. And this Blunk was born in December of 26th, 1911. Oh, there goes a cutback a few years. It's good to see you. Just before I go talking about some of the things that I would like to say, let me first say that I'm very glad to be present here with Al and Mike. The only thing problem with that is I'm outnumbered by Gottlieb, so but I'll do my best. And we also miss Dwayne Nyans, who has been having a little problem in Mountain Home, Arkansas, with his wife. He couldn't be here with us, and he would be a pleasant addition to this group if he was able to be here. In the meantime, we shall do it this weekend to try to entertain you to the point of letting you know some of the exciting things that happen in our time in the business. And I can begin by telling you that I started working with Genco, G-E-N-C-O, three Gensburg brothers, back in 1937. And I had a hell of a time with them because they were the type of people that did everything they could for their employees, as well as Gottlieb did for theirs. That's why they remained in the business with those same people for so many years and were so effective in being so well received in the business, and with their, not only with their games, but with their ability to be able to keep people at their place. One of the things that I would like to say about the games that I had been working with, I had worked with a man called Harvey Heiss, and I had an opportunity to learn something from him during that period of time, which later on gave me an opportunity to be able to design her and have a lot of fun. And I finally, at Genco, while I was at Genco, I had the great opportunity to be able to use the effective idea of having flippers on the game as originally put in by Gottlieb in 1947. It was in 1947 when they came out with six flippers and started doing something in the industry. Everybody, whenever anybody asks me what were some of the things that happened in this industry that you think that affected it to some degree, they ask me about the name Tilt and other actions and games. But I've always said this, and I'll repeat this again, I don't think there was anything in a business that ever happened more effectively to affect the entire industry but flippers. The reason for that was because when the flippers were invented and put on games, you couldn't buy, sell, or even play a game that did not have flippers. And of course, we remember the number of additional that we sold to the world and making old games changed over to flippers by putting them on games. Every so often, I'm sure you have the same thing, happens to me. I find a game that I built that had no flippers, then all of a sudden I find it with flippers. I wonder how the hell did that get on there? Well, it was the only way you were able to sell the game at that time. During the time that I was with Genco, I had learned from Harvey Heiss things that I enjoyed. There's something we can talk more about later on, but I want to take, don't keep the floor too much. I'd like to hear some more from some of the other people here. In the meantime, what happened is when Genco closed their doors in the 50s, I managed to get to Gottlieb to Bally for a year and a half, and then change over to Williams Electronics, at which place I had my best successes. It was very wonderful to be there. I enjoyed it very much. I'll talk more about that later on, but in the meantime, I'd like to transfer it to somebody else.
You'd like to stand up?
Take your time.
Okay. My new hip makes me move a little slower than usual. I'm Alvin Godfrey, son of the founder of DeGodfrey & Company, one of the first people to build coin-operated marble tables, they were called, back in the 30s. And I want to make one remark with Norm Clark here and Steve Kordick and others that have been in the business. At this point in our lives, the aspect of competition is gone. Because I feel that Steve and Norm and Wayne Knight, we're all part of a family that were the founders and the pushers and the shakers and the movers of the pinball business. And I was born, my father said, at a very young age. He said I was so surprised I didn't talk for 2 years. But that was Dave Gottlieb's sense of humor, which was carried through right on into the business and throughout many, many years. And let me tell you, trying to fill the shoes of Dave Gottlieb was an impossible, impossible effort. The best we could do, and the best I wanted to do, was attempt to follow and be in the business and run it as he had done, where he said there's only one way to run a business, and that's the right way. With respect to the employees, he said, Alvin, take care of your people, and they'll take care of you. So as a consequence, the thread of Dave Gottlieb's name runs throughout the business from day one until the time he retired and moved on. I started in the business in 1947. I got out of the Navy and went to Chicago Technical College for a couple of years, and then went into the, my whole ambition was to get into the business. I loved the business, I always wanted to be a part of it, and one day Dave Gottlieb waltzed me into the engineering department and said to Bob Smith, here, teach him everything there is to know about building pinball machines, but do it in just 2 years. Well, I had the privilege and pleasure of sitting next to the bench with Wayne Nyans for many years. Wayne, to me, was, again, almost like an older brother, because his attitude was, I'm going to do my job as best I can, you watch what I'm doing, and don't make any mistakes. Our chief engineer at that time was Bob Smith. Bob Smith had one attitude. There was no such thing as good. It was either acceptable or not acceptable, and that went in through the history of the business, what the point of making our product as most efficient and most economical as we possibly could. And that ran through the years. And Steve and I were just sitting here. He said something to the effect when Rob Burke showed him some of these solid-state devices and the LEDs, and Steve made the remark, I'm a mechanical man. So am I. I loved the business. I had a great deal of fun in the business. I ran the full gamut of being told that we do what's necessary at the time it needs doing, and that ran the gamut from design, engineering, production, plant facilities, the legal aspect of the business, the employee relations, which somehow wound up with one of my bags, so to speak. And over many, many years, it became an entire family procedure. The people that started there with Dave Gottlieb, there was one gentleman who started in 1927. Working for Dave Gottlieb, his name was Joe Lethowski, and became known for the next 50-some-odd years simply as Polak Joe. And he was the kind of person that emulated the work ethic of so many people at the Gottlieb plant. And we had, in those days, they had, a large population of Polish people, and they were probably the work ethic itself, the epitome of it. These people, our whole families came to work, and they were so conscientious and such wonderful people. There's an anecdote about Polak Joe Latowski. When I came to work, the engineering department, 1947, Bob Smith said, go to the tool room and get some tools. You need some tools to work with. Well, I went to the stock room and I told Polak Joe, I said, Joe, I need a pair of wire cutters, screwdrivers, gas pliers, etc. Okay, you got it. Well, he brought it up to the counter and then he handed me a ticket. And he says, you sign it. And I said, what's the matter? He said, you don't get it. And I used the vernacular, he spoke it in Polish. He said, you don't get it, no tools, if you don't sign a ticket. I said, Joe, my father owns this place. I don't care. You sign a ticket, no ticket, no tools. All right, okay. We're bringing him forward. Joe Latowski and his wife were such close members of the family. There were periods of time when my mother and dad would leave town, and Joe and his wife would come babysit at the house. And he was nice to me, but he was tough. You know, as the years went by, when the flipper came into being, it was a very monumental event. I was in the room working with Harry Mabbs, more or less being a student of Harry. Harry Mabbs, who invented the flipper, was a very unusual character in and of himself. He was an electrician. He had been in the United States Navy when they called their sailors tars. And he told me stories of he had long hair and they used tar to keep the hair in place while they were aboard the ship. Anyway, my relationship with Harry was just amazing. We related stories constantly of some of the things he was involved in early days. One of the things he was most proud of was that he did the entire wiring of the Flagler race course in the Miami area. And Harry was an unusual type of genius, and that when he wired a game, it was a point-to-point grab, whatever color wire came off the rack, and soldered it in and make the game work. Well, as a consequence, when he would bring a game to the engineering department to be developed for production, they had to totally ignore the insides of the game. And it became Wayne Nyan's job was to build that game and wire it so it could be made in production, so that they could make the wiring harnesses, etc. Well, Wayne taught me how to do the wiring. There was a Frank Underhill who taught me how to lace the cables using that wax twine that we did. And then Wayne taught me how to build the test fixtures. And a test fixture was a conglomeration of switches and relays, etc. And the numbers, the switches were all numbered, and we had to write a sequence of testing operations. And the point being, for every switch on the test fixture, it would test some part of the game. And bearing in mind that I was very green at this, they had a lot of patience with me. And on occasion when things didn't come the way I thought they should, they were very kind to help me get squared away. But I could hear them mumbling in the background about something about why I had this guy to contend with now. But it was a pleasure working with him. The fellow that I shared an office with, Tony Girard, was at one time the head of the tool and die shop of D. Gottlieb & Company. And in later years, Dave Gottlieb made him the superintendent of the plant. And he and Bob Smith rode the same track where there was nothing really good, but either was acceptable and usable, or discarded and reworked. And throughout the course of the years, they developed the procedure of life testing all of the components in the Gottlieb games. And in later years, when we got into our new plant, we had a soundproof, fireproof room where every component was hooked up to a series of motors and switches with counters, so we knew exactly what the life of every component was. It was an interesting aspect of the operation of the business because it wasn't a situation of where we were going to slap games together and get them out the door. Either they worked or they didn't, and if they didn't work properly, they wouldn't go out the door, because there was a reputation that Dave Gottlieb had established. Cute anecdote in connection with that. Dave Gottlieb had his logo, "There is no substitute for quality." And one day I asked him, "Well, where did you think that up? Where did it come from?" He said, "Oh, that was on a sign over a drugstore in Dallas." And then in those early days, he had a little decalcomania, which was like the Gottlieb coat of arms, and had that stuck to all of the games that came out of the plant for many years. And one day I asked him, "Well, who did you have make this Gottlieb coat of arms?" He said, "Oh, I took that off of a Cadillac Hubcap." You know, in those early days, the people that in the business had tremendous sense of humor. Dave Gottlieb once bragged, "When someone builds better games, Gottlieb will copy them." And in those days, there were...
We went the same direction.
Yeah. You know, there were so many creative people in the business. Gottlieb didn't have an exclusive on creativity. However, I think one of the successes of our side of the business was in producing a item that would go out, and we had confidence in knowing that it was going to work. Dave Gottlieb always bragged. He said nobody ever lost money operating a Gottlieb game. And he was very proud of that, and that permeated the entire business, where we were so conscientious about producing an item. I spent many, many, many hours at the end of the assembly lines and inspecting all of the connections and trying to examine everything I possibly could. I could spot a cold solder joint at about 20 feet. And I would go through the games, and if I found something bad, something that wasn't exactly what it should be, I would get hold of the foreman, and literally the stuff would hit the fan because we wouldn't put up with secondary work. Strange things would happen during the course of trying to produce games. In the days where we made all of our own switches, of course, the ladies would sit at the benches and operate these little riveting machines that would rivet the silver contact points into the switch blades. And one day we started running into a tremendous amount of trouble with contacts that weren't working. But finally, with the investigation, it narrowed down. But some lady decided that the lady's hands were being roughed up by this procedure, and she brought in some bottles of Lubriderm, and the ladies were oiling their hands up with this stuff, and it got into the contact points. Lubriderm would not conduct electricity. We had to go through all of the stuff they had handled it, washed it all off with alcohol, and start all over again and told them, "Please, you can use this stuff on your hands, do it at home, not at the factory." And again, that's stories that go on like that infinitum, where we would get shipments of steel that are supposedly what call Armco, which was wouldn't hold magnetism so that our relays wouldn't stick from the electromagnetic coils. And we ran very well, things went along well, and one day a shipment of cold rolled sock came in, which we thought and was promoted to be an Armco, and it wasn't. We stamped out thousands of relay armatures, started to assemble things, and all of a sudden the game stuck. The armatures wouldn't drop out, the games wouldn't operate at all. Shut the factory down. Don't send anybody home. Dave Gottlieb didn't believe in that. He said, "I don't want to have anybody going home at the end of the week without a payroll." Everybody sit there, take all of these parts with a magnet and examine them, go through every game, every nut, screw, wire, start all over again. And that is the basis of the foundation of why Dave Gottlieb and his No Substitute for Quality enabled D. Gottlieb to come, as I had said yesterday, under the guidance of my brother-in-law, Judd Weinberg, under his watch, At one point, the world's largest manufacturer of coin-operated pinball machines. We operated in a small factory in Costner Avenue, 40,000 square feet, and manufactured many, many thousands of games there. And in later years, they moved. It became apparent that we had to move the facilities to a larger plant. The export market was blossoming, and we needed a lot of games. And that's when the Northlake plant came into being. And I enjoyed the privilege of helping design that factory specifically to design amusement-type pinball machines in the most efficient way as possible. And when we finished with that plant, we were about 238,000 square feet, and we had one of the finest assembly factories in the Chicago area. So much so that we could have built television sets or toasters or refrigerators or anything like that, because we had the facilities for it. And I would take Dave Gottlieb through the punch press department to show him how great things were running back there. And of course, the punch presses were blanking away, slamming out tremendous noises. And my father had a grin on his face, and I said, "What's so funny?" He says, "Those are my cash registers ringing in there." You know, I can go on ad infinitum about details of the business and some of the problems we encountered. One of the questions that was raised yesterday was the problem of gambling devices and our pinball machines being misidentified as gambling devices, and how much time we spent traveling around the country and in Washington, D.C. with the Internal Revenue Service so that we could get the differentiation and that there was a delineation between the gambling equipment and the amusement pinballs. And I feel quite confident if we hadn't stuck our neck out along with Sam Stern and Williams, who helped us finance the attorneys, the lawyers on this thing, pinball business could have very easily been knocked out the window. But as a consequence of a lot of work, people came to recognize that this is purely an amusement device and operated it. So at one time there was a question yesterday about why were there so many up to 26 free games allowed on some of the older games. Well, in those days, those games did have knockoff buttons, and if you accumulated 10, 15, 20, whatever games, you could go to the storekeeper or the bartender and get paid off, and then the button would remove the games that had been paid off, and it was recorded on a meter inside the game so that at the end of the week, the operator could reimburse the bartender for what he had paid out. And Dave Gottlieb and Sam Stern became very adamant about the fact that they had to remove those knockoff buttons and reduce the amount of free plays that could be awarded. And as a consequence, we developed a unit that only went to 10 free plays, and there were no knockoff buttons. And that knockoff button became kind of like an identifier of what the gambling devices were. And our dear friends over at Valley wouldn't stand for that, so they took their knockoff buttons off also. But then they wired the game so that if you hit the bottom of the cabinet the right way, the same thing would happen. It would knock the games off and record it. The reason I mention that about Valley, they had probably one of the most fantastic engineering departments in the business. They had some engineers over there that developed some equipment that never ceased to amaze all of us how much time and money they could put into those devices. The answer to it was that those were borderline, if not fully, gambling devices and made a tremendous amount of money for the operators. So there was always that being at odds as to, oh, a pinball is a pinball, is a slot machine, etc. And we ran the gamut of problems with that, with local city fathers saying, oh, put a coin in the slot, that's a slot machine, you're out, through. No, we wouldn't stand for that. Got very deeply involved in it, and with the Internal Revenue Service, because there was a legislation passed where there was a $10 excise tax on amusement devices and a $250 tax on gambling devices. And there was that confusion again with the delineation of what was what. And Rufus King and I went to Washington, sat with the gentleman who wrote some of these IRS laws, convinced him that what we had was purely an amusement machine, and there were, quote, other devices that came under the aegis of a gambling device. And then we wound up, they promulgated some legislation, and we came through to where it was recognized that we were building an amusement device. And then in response to some of the confusion, I sat down with Rufus King, and we wrote, if you've seen some of the Gottlieb games, up in the left-hand corner, there was a little certificate where we made the statement that this was an amusement device, not subject to some legal gobbledygook defining the number of the code and whatever, and was not subject. My alter ego here was not subject to regulation. Steve, Michael reminded me that I'm shooting my face off here, and you had as much, if not more, experience in the business than I did. Steve's as our senior. What category, Steve?
Just told.
Just told. Thank heavens he's with us. Though. Steve was so active in the early days when the businesses were really tough. And back in the early days, I recall vividly where the manufacturers used similar components, and there'd be times when Bally would run out of a part and the Gottlieb sales department would ship parts over to help them out, and then we'd run out of part and we'd call over to Williams and, hey, we need such and such a thing, and they have a guy in a car within hours bring it over to our plant so that our assembly lines would keep running.
Correct, Steve?
Right. We had one hell of an association.
Nice people.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. Good review. One of the things I would like to remind, I can't help but remember, particularly about Harry Max, I have got to know him very well, because when I came to work at Williams in 1960, he had just come there from several years before then, from Gottlieb, and I had quite an association with him because I worked with him for about 1 year, and then he left and retired. When he went to Hollywood, Florida to retire, my wife and I visited him there several times, and it was a pleasure to know him. He was quite a man. I think when he retired, he was in the 70s, I think, at that time.
Oh, yeah.
And was a terrific man. I'm sure he was a capable man. Some of the stories that he told me, were rather personal. I can't ever repeat it, but I have to tell it to you. Anyway, I got a kick out of the point that I brought about the Polish people in this area. I had the same experience with Genco on Ashland Avenue, because we were about two blocks away from Gottlieb, when we were on the Verzi. And if we were in an area of Polish Polish extraction. And we had majority of our people are of Polish extraction. And how did we get along with them? Easily, because we are hiring women that were glad to work during this almost depression time, as you might say. And they send their kids to school, come over to work with us, and when we were ready to pick up their kids, they go back home. And we had quite a few of them. We were very, very, very much dependent on them when the war broke out. Because at that time, we couldn't build pin games. We couldn't get the materials that were necessary to build them. So consequently, we would get involved in military work. And some of the things that all of us built were very, very necessary in the business. And I like to repeat this because this is something exciting. The first thing we started making in our place were walkie-talkies for the Marines. We had our own radio station in our place, and it was something that exciting to have these people learn how to work. We would use these changes of transmission for these walkie-talkies. And I always brag about one of the biggest contracts that we ever got in our place. I don't repeat this to many people very often, but let me tell you what it was. We received the contract from the Air Force that we could that we built a cable, nothing else but just a cable that had about 50 to 70 wires on it. But that cable had to be built, every wire had to be exactly the same color. Now, can you imagine making a cable that had 50, 70 wires and with terminals in four or five different places? They all had to be coming in the right places. Well, those of us in the pinball business, it wasn't too difficult for us to do. The difficulty part was the same color. Why was it the same color? Because the cables that we were making for the Air Force were used for anti-radar business, and they were always worried that if one of them were found on a airplane that had it and was captured, they'd never be able to figure out how to put this thing together because I had the same colors. And of course, we did a lot of other things, just like all the other companies and the businesses, but it was very exciting to be in it. Getting back to the Polish extraction of people, get a kick out of it. Your Polish joke, because he must have been quite that character. And the reason I get a kick out of it is because my father was from Poland, my mother was American, left of me is Polish, the right side of me is English, I don't know what's the middle of me. Anyway, I speak the language fluently, read it, write it, and so forth. And it's fun to know that, it's good to know that the association we had in this business was something that made the business what it was. And I personally had one heck of a time in it because I had did it. I personally had made many, many games. I just made a notation here before I came here to make a notation that I was involved in 140 games with Genko, where I had major responsibility for the electrical wiring of the games. I had an electrical background when I came into the business, so it helped me tremendously in the business. Those of you who do not know how I got into the business, since there are so many of you here that are first here for the first time, let me tell you that I have been in the Civilian Conservation, CCCs, the Conservation Corps in Idaho, and I had been transferred to the working with the Department of Agriculture under the Forest Department. I got working in a ranger station, and I got to be a dispatcher at a ranger station, and they used to call me a city slicker because I was from Chicago and I was not one of the current contacts of people. They called me the city slicker because I used to challenge anybody to climb to a tower, to a lookout tower, and beat them going up there. That was something exciting. And I was in Chicago, and I used to run the marathon races that they used to run on the lakefront in those days. And I was in pretty good condition, so I had one leg at a time. It was great. It was one of the great times that I had. Getting back to the business itself, I learned a lot from Harvey, as I told you. I then, when I left Genko, when it closed up, I got a year and a half of experience in Dallin for three games. And then I got involved with Williams, where I did my own personal games that I made, or 87 of them. And I was involved in about 45, 50 to 60 other games with the other designers that we had on our plan. And they were some very exciting people that made some of the most exciting games that you probably know and have played. But the only other thing I'd like to tell you is that it's always great to get together with godly people, because to us at Williams and Genco, we always knew that Gottlieb was one of the top people in the industry, and talking about copying each other's ideas, well, we did the same thing. We had a chance to find something that was really good. We tried it. We copied it, and of course, we thought we were always improved on it, as you did with some of the things that we took from us. It was exciting. The business was very exciting. Very competitive, but it was very exciting. And as far as making the testing games on location, they always knew where we had our test games, and of course, we knew where they had their test games, so it always worked out very nicely. Anyway, it was very exciting, and I'll tell you one thing. It was the greatest time in my life. I don't think I've ever had more fun in any bit of anything but being in this business. And I think I gained a lot for it. I think I gave a lot to the people. And I am sure that it's something that I'll never forget. I made it for number 23 over here. Good Lord willing, I hope we make it for number 24. That's about all I have to say, except for the look. And then, I guess you got to know my age. December 26th, I'll be 26.
It's a magic number.
So, you know, so many people are here for the first time. Just as a sense of perspective, I also wanted to recognize the third pillar, if you will, the pillar of Bally, which is this gentleman right here, Norm Clark. Norm Clark was a visionary. He ran the engineering department at Bally for the longest period of time, through the heyday, through all those wonderful, wonderful Bally games, worked through the you know, bringing things to solid state. And, you know, pretty much between Norm and Steve and my father, I mean, you're looking at the heyday here. You're looking at the men that drove Bally, Gottlieb, and Williams through the golden age, if you will, certainly in the 70s. And the other thing that is really special about Norm Clark and Steve Kordick is that these gentlemen had been in the business for a very long period of time. Things had remained the same for a very long period of time, and then came along solid state. And, you know, Norm was one of the leaders that led the initiative on the Bally side, and Steve was one of the leaders that led the initiative on the Williams side. And going from electromechanical to solid state was just a huge monumental undertaking, and these gentlemen were the drivers behind that. So in any case, I just wanted to recognize Norm. We love you, Norm.
I got a question for you.
Yes.
I asked Mike, but I don't like his answers. I'm going to ask you. How come the Gottlieb games, even to this day, have this distinctive smell? You open up that game in the back box, and there's that aroma. You know it's a Gottlieb game. With your eyes closed, you know it's a Gottlieb game.
That's an interesting point, and there's a story connected with it. I have to put it on this level for those of you who have looked inside any of the older Gottlieb games, even the later ones, you'll notice that the switches were stacked, interleaved with what we call canvas impregnated Bakelite. And the switch blades were staked together, and over a period of time, that canvas Bakelite would cook out and shrink, and the switch blades themselves would become out of adjustment. Well, to counteract that, what we did was we always stamped out the canvas Bakelite separators ourselves, and we constructed ovens and put them in the ovens and cooked them. Well, the process resulted in formaldehyde, a version of formaldehyde called formalin, which smelled to high heaven. And we had to construct an external exhaust system to get that smell out of the factory. It never got away. You're talking about it, that's
the genesis of
it. It wasn't a bad smell. I just...
That was the smell.
Is it okay to breathe it?
Not much. There's a story connected with everything. Distilling down our being here now is, to me, a remarkable thing, in that the people that have interests in pinball machines today verify all of the feelings that the original people in the game business had, was we're providing an amusement. And that's what they've got. So we're providing an amusement for the average guy. Today you don't want to spend $6 to a movie and see a blood and fire, guts and whatever. But it's an amusement business. And there's a possibility that many of the people that enjoy being in the business went on to other areas of entertainment. And we had somewhat of an association. In later years, we sold out to Columbia Pictures. And I was a part of that for about 5 years. And that Judd Weinberg, who was the president of our company, didn't last but 2 years. And it turned out, he said, I can't handle this. I said, what's the matter? He says, this huge corporate mega structure, you have to have a meeting to have a meeting to decide who's going to be at the meeting, who's going to decide at the next meeting. Judd and I ran our business. He and I would sit down, we'd have a discussion, agree on something. That was it in the business frame. Also, Steve mentioned about during World War II, and before I went in the Navy, I would work at the plant as a delivery man. Our company, the Gottlieb Company, made tools and dies, and they made tools for stamping out 50 caliber machine gun clips. And we were a subcontractor to Stuart Warner, and I was driving a family old beat-up Buick, delivering these tools and dies to the companies and then bringing them back to be sharpened. At one time, the company manufactured parachute static hooks. I don't know if you've seen the old movies where the paratroopers would take their hook onto the center cable down to the center of the aircraft and bail out. The Gottlieb Company manufactured those static hooks, they were called, and also another device called a cargo hook, where they did also, where they're bailing out cargo with parachutes, they too would clip onto this cable down the center. They had built a device at the plant to test these two different devices. It was enclosed in a metal cabinet, and it was a hydraulic procedure, and these things would crank up the pressure up to X tens of thousands of pounds. I don't remember the number, but I recall having been on the plant at one time when one of them let go, and it sounded like a grenade when that thing exploded. But every cargo hook, every static hook that went out of that factory went through that test. One quick aside connecting the pinball business, the Gottlieb Company also had a contract to stamp out a cap for a rocket fuse. And this thing, a circular device, and it had 12 holes punched in the periphery. And the process would be to put it into what's called a step punch press, and the guy would have to hit the pedal 12 times to punch holes in the periphery of this thing. Dave Gottlieb said, this is a terrible way of doing it. So the engineers at the department, get this thing done right. They took a step switch from the Gottlieb pinball machine, wired it into the punch press, and a pneumatic cylinder, so this thing would automatically stamp out 12 holes, and another cylinder would throw it off into a bucket. That was some of the involvement in the World War II. It's such a pleasure seeing people, and I have to address it some for the people here the first time. Anybody, to me, that has an interest in the pinball machine has a degree of innate enjoyment in themselves in playing games. Today, the game business, as witnessed by Michael working with the Midway Home Entertainment, the game business and the videos have become so exotic that it's almost beyond my comprehension. I see the kids playing these things, and
I want to get back to a little old pinball. Thank you for my award being inducted in the Pinball Hall of Fame. I appreciate it. And it's wonderful to be here with Norm and Steve. And I look forward to whatever year. My first remark was, it's nice being here. At our age, it's nice being anywhere.
Questions?
I have one more for Steve and Al. What was your favorite era and why?
Your favorite era and why?
Oh, wow.
Steve, why don't you start? So you were in the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s?
To say what era, because it's very difficult to say what era, because to us, every era to us was very, very important. It wasn't a question of which was most important. It seemed like any time you talk about, I don't care which way you're talking about, there was something very, very important about it that affected us positively and the company. And that's very, very important. And to me, as far as I was concerned, it affected me personally. And that was very, very important. Now, if you want to ask me, what do I think about I personally think where I make some of the best games in learning, that's another. But I'm talking about era. You're talking about an era.
Your favorite era now. You're,
yeah. I have no favorite era. Every one of them is great.
Bless you, you're so right. My answer to the question, my most favorite era, was when we had completed our North Lake factory. The export market was booming, and it was a thrill, I mean a genuine thrill, to walk through the Gottlieb North Lake plant that was turning out something a little over 250 games a day, and walk through that factory and see all of those hundreds of employees in this beautiful, clean, air-conditioned, pleasant place to work throughout the entire plant, and go through all the different divisions of it, the welding department, the French press department, the assembly lines, spot welding lines, everything functioning, clicking exactly as we had designed it. And it was my feeling, like Dave Gottlieb remarked about the punch presses, that's my cash register. To me, it was the epitome, really, of what we had attempted to do throughout all the years of building a product that would make people money. That was the whole point. And when I spoke to them frequently, I had occasions to talk to our employees, hundreds of them at a time. I said, you've got to understand something. We're all here to make money. It's pleasant talking with you and seeing with you, but this is a business. And the business was of entertainment and amusement. And that was the biggest thrill, of course, of my lifetime. Any question here?
Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about the competition between the two companies, or all the companies? Was it friendly, or did it get more serious at times?
Well, as I understand the question, you're asking about friendliness between the operators of the companies?
Competition, were they friendly?
Well, the competition, yes, they were always friendly, but bearing in mind that the principals of most of these companies, as I mentioned yesterday, Dave Gottlieb, Dave Rocola, the Bally Company, with all these people that had started back in the 20s, and they had worked together and had associations, business associations, to promulgate their businesses. And in spite of the fact that there was a divergence of opinion in connection with what areas and which directions their games were going to go, these people always had a very high respect for each other. As I mentioned, my respect for the engineering department, my own engineering department, and the engineers over at Valley, and then the people in the Ginsberg brothers. You know, there were so many people in the early days that had worked together and stayed in the business for many, many years. And in spite of the fact that the competition was there, of course there was competition. When Gottlieb built a new game, the other people got a hold of samples and took a look at them. We would get the Williams and Valley games in our place. That was part of the business. You wanted to see what your competition was doing. And if it was really good, you'd try and copy it.
Improve on it.
Yeah, now in the past presser that Stern now owns that came from Gottlieb, is that one that was at Gottlieb from the very beginning, or?
Well, the pants presser, for those of you who don't know what a pants presser is, it's a hydraulic press, and it has a platen in it which had little nail holes all over the surface, and they would put a play field in there and squash it down, and that would mark the location of screws. Oh yeah, on both sides of the board. And in the early days, before the pants presser, there was what was known as drill chicks, where there was a steel plate with holes in it, and an operator would have a pneumatic air drill and punch holes in wherever the screws in the playboard would be. And then in later years, the pants presser, as we call it, was developed so that all of those holes, top and bottom, as Steve was reminding me, that whole thing was squashed together, and bottom and top, all the holes were spotted all in one stroke.
I think that machine you're talking about, Sam, I think that was bought with the North Lake plant, when the North Lake plant got built. John, do you know?
No, it just always seemed like a very old piece of equipment. I assume it was from the Costner years.
Yeah, it might have been.
Another question. Yes, this is for Alvin. Got it. Sir, you can probably answer a question about a folklore story I heard about Gottlieb. You all made a game called The Challenger, which a player stood at either end of the playfield tilted back and forth. I had a game for a brief while of one of those. I was told that the company lost so much money on that game that you all had some kind of ceremony where you piled all the remaining games and parts in the center and smashed them up. Now, is there any truth at all to that place?
Well, not exactly. I know all the other companies have experiences that we did where we were always trying to make something a little different, because every one of our customers, all the distributors, would come in for visits or for conventions, and the cry was the same, give us something different. And we would attempt to make something different, and if it didn't work, what we did was we said, send it to the boiler room. And at both of our factories, we had a boiler room, and it was all of this stuff was taken in there. The usable parts, were stripped off and put into boxes, and the wooden parts were thrown in the furnace. So that's maybe where that story came from.
I get a kick out of asking about burning some equipment. Whenever you mention something about burning something, I would like to repeat this story, which I think is terrific. First of all, let me tell you that working for Genco and for I was very, very much involved in making gun games, and our biggest problem at one time was trying to get rifles that we could use, because we used actual rifles. We finally got in touch with Remington, and when we got to Remington, what we got to do is, we got their rejects. They weren't rejects, but we got them $14 a piece. That was something. It worked out very nicely. But getting back to burning, this is, it makes me laugh when I think about this, and you're going to get a kick out of it when I tell you this, because many people do not know this. When we left Genco and it closed up, I had three people with me who were working for 20-some years at Genco, and that were electrical men, mechanical men, and John Murphy, who used to take our equipment games on the line, and of course, I was the designer. Anyway, I was doing everything I could to try to get us together in one company, because everybody wanted to hire me as a designer, but nobody wanted to take all three of us. Anyway, I went over to Seabird. I went over to Seabird because they just got through making a game and had to finally set Burn in the back of their place, about almost 1,000 games, because they could not sell them. Why couldn't they sell them? It was a gun game. The name of the game?
Shoot the bear.
Shoot the bear.
Coon Hunt.
Oh.
It had a raccoon in it. You're talking about the baseball. They did that job. They made a hell of a lot of money. But the smart engineers decided to make another game, almost just like it, but instead put a raccoon on it. So they decided to call the game Coon Hunt. Can you imagine trying to sell that game in the South?
Yes.
Well, they didn't sell it. They burned them.
One anecdote in connection with the gun game Steve's talking about. During the war, Seabird built a game called Shoot the Jap. And in later years, it was converted over to, as Steve mentioned, the Coon Hunt. What one?
Yeah, well, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but the Challenger story I'm aware of is that you guys put Challenger on a test, it didn't do all that well, and you had, maybe it was a Canadian distributor, come in and take a look at it, and said, this is great, I love this. And Dave Gottlieb said, no, it's not, you don't want it. And the Canadian guy said, oh, no, this is it, this is the next big thing, I want some number of games, I don't know if it was 100 or 300, there was some number of games, and Dave Gottlieb said, no, you're going to lose money on this product. You do not want this game. And the Canadian guy says, how about if I pay you up front for all of the games, I'll give you the cash ahead of time to build them, I really want them. And the guy said, Dave Gottlieb said, it's your money, you want the games, I'll build you the games. That's the story I remember.
What I heard piecing together over several expos is that there were 70 test pieces, and then this guy in Canada ordered 400 more. So the total number is 470 made.
Well, not everybody, Steve here. Suffice to say, not every game that everybody designed and engineered was successful. We tried. We built a skee ball in, which was an offshoot of the Evans 10 strike. And then we, as I said, we built the Bowlet, which was a little bitty bowling game. Shuffle Bowler, right, was when Lynn Durant hit the jackpot with his shuffle bowling devices. We another one. Sold a few. It was a cute thing, but not the quantities that the company needed to make money. Yes.
After all these years, I finally found out something which I never knew. In the Gottlieb games, there was the AG switch, right?
The AG relay.
AG relay.
So I just realized yesterday, the Elvin Gottlieb relay.
Yeah.
It just dawned on me yesterday. Are there any other switches, the MG relay or any other family members that made it?
Well, there's a story behind the AG relay, the Elvin Gottlieb relay. Before that one came into use, we were using what was known as an R-type relay, which we had copied many years earlier from some other relay manufacturer. And the problems we were having was relay bounce. With that and our old magnet relay, that had long switch blades. In other words, the ball would hit a bumper or something, and the relay would pull in, and sometimes if the switch bounced, it wouldn't carry the circuit onto the rest of the game. And as a consequence, we were having problems with it. And Bob Smith had a test fixture rigged up with a stroboscope and a timer and an oscilloscope, and we could actually see the contact bounce during the course of the operation of a relay. And I got in with Doc Garbar, our mechanical engineer, and said, Doc, we've got to come up with something that's new and different and not going to have that problem. And Doc came up with the AG relay that you'll see in later Gottlieb games that had very short tapered switch blades. The purpose of that was there was not any inherent harmonic vibration in a tapered blade. And being short like that, it was a very fast action relay. And when Doc finally finished his drawing, he put the AG on there. I said, what's that? You know, he said, well, that's Alvin Gottlieb. Oh, my goodness, that's interesting. Because in the early days, Mike had mentioned I printed the first parts catalog for the pinball machine business. There was no such thing in the early days. There was a mimeograph sheet of paper, which had a little drawing of parts on it and a written description of what the parts were. And when I started to print a catalog, I'd come across a relay, an assembled unit, and I named it SA. I asked me, what's that? It's a special assembly. I was in a position to pick out the numbers I wanted. That's the genesis of the AG. It was a very good relay. A quick anecdote, which doesn't sit well with the Williams people, because at the time we developed the AG relay, they were manufacturing what was called the old R-type relay, which we sold from Guardian Electric. And when they were in production with that relay, they ran out of some parts and called us up, and we shipped them all the parts they needed to continue manufacturing a relay, which we discarded.
Anecdotes.
It's 12 o'clock. We'll almost call it quits. But since we're talking about each other's experiences, and I have so many of mine personally that I could talk about, and I haven't just got time to tell you about all of them because there's so many of them having to do with the Ginsburg brothers and so forth. So I would like to finalize it by just one thing. When Benko closed, when Genko closed down, we had four people left, that myself, an electrical engineer, a good mechanical engineer, and one person who used to take the games on the line and take care of them. And all we worked together for almost 20 years together. Bingo, we're all out, right? I get a call from several companies. They want to hire me as a design engineer for pin games. I said, well, I'm going to get a job for these other three guys. I'm not going to go by myself. I'd like to get these other four. No, we don't want nobody else. We just want you. No. I went to Seabird. I thought because we were making good gun games, because they had a bad problem with their coon hunt, I figured maybe they would take us. They listened to me and they were very interested. That Luna Castor was one of them in there. And what happened is, after some consideration, they said they had made such a bad reputation, they wouldn't hire us. Okay, Linda Rand wanted to hire me, but he wouldn't take all four of us. So I had no other alternative. I went to my good friend Bill O'Donnell at Valley. He says, Bill, I got a problem. What's your problem? I told him, I says, I got these three guys with me, and everybody wants to hire me, but nobody wants to take the four guys that were left. Where are they going to go looking for a job? You know what he said? I'll take all four of you. And that happened in 1958. Now, I'm there for a year and a half, and through the grapevine, there was never such a thing as somebody wanting to hire somebody from another company directly, a person. It would be a background deal. Would you please call this or this person, somebody who would like to talk to you. Sam Stern made an offer for me as a pin game player. So I went to Bill O'Donnell, and said, I got a problem. He says, what's your problem now? I said, I got a good job now for a good salary with somebody. And I told him who. And he says to me, I congratulate you. You're going to go. You promised me one thing. Don't you dare take any one of these three guys out of this place that you brought in here. Did you know that all three of those fellows worked there for another 7, 8, 9 years, and each one of them retired from Bell? Can you imagine that? That, I felt so good about that because at least I had something to do with that. That's a part of my life. I went in here, Baumrod. My wife and I, we were married 62 years when I lost her. That's something that people don't make us believe. But I'll tell you what, she deserved half a dozen medals, having been married to one guy for that many years.